Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We have another episode for you today, a bunch of stuff to talk about. We have the thing that I'm most interested in right now is still coming out of these cryptic, but I think easy to interpret comments from Joe Manchin of West Virginia on the Sunday shows this weekend. And I think, I don't know if he went on every single Sunday show, but he went on like at least three of the four or a bunch of them, you know, where you kind of make the rounds. And these things are very, these things don't happen by happenstance. You know, when you book yourself on every show and you clearly have one topic that you want to get into with people. And in my mind, it was a big deal because if you assume that the filibuster in its current form is not going anywhere, which is certainly a pretty plausible way to interpret the sort of statements of filibuster worship from Joe Manchin, but even more from Kyrsten Sinema, right? A kind of like her whole ideology is just preserving the filibuster. It's easy to think like, okay, you know, you get the COVID relief bill, which is great, and certainly the first priority. But after that, like, good luck, like nothing's going to happen. But Manchin, in my mind, pretty clearly opened the door. And what made it significant to me is that if you talk to the longtime anti-filibuster reformers, mainly ex-staffers, some think tank people and stuff like that. But the people have been on this for a while and are generally not disposed towards aspirational or wishful thinking, have been saying for months, don't talk about abolishing the filibuster. Talk about reforming the filibuster and even saving the filibuster. That the only way you're going to make this happen is if you change the mechanisms of the filibuster, that the people who either support it or are, you know, kind of filibuster curious, if those people can say, we're not getting rid of it, we're saving it, we're reforming it and you know, bringing it into the 21st century, and we're going to ward off forever people who want to get rid of it. And what Manchin said, you know, was exactly from that script, which made me understand what I have been surprised by, which is the general confidence or optimism of the people who work this issue. You know, right after Biden was sworn in, Joe Manchin made a series of comments, basically, yep, I love the filibuster, never getting rid of it. Don't ask me again, because my answer is never going to change for eternity. And then, you know, Sinema getting in and basically saying the same thing. But he's now saying that same kind of thing. You know, we're going to reform it. We'll make it more painful make it more painful to do it. And once that's the case, this does not mean, and I think he has also been, Manchin has been very clear, he's not talking about changing the Senate to just 50 votes, when, you know, 51 votes whenever. But you put some limits on the filibuster. Don't make it just a easy veto on anything. Suddenly, the big voting rights bill starts to seem more possible. Maybe Democrats don't get everything they want, but like some version of that being possible. A big, big infrastructure bill suddenly starts to seem much more plausible. And, you know, climate, a whole host of things. Now, you know, no party in power gets everything it wants, certainly not when you have sort of like only like a quasi-majority. You have a tie and then you have the vice president. But the whole picture starts to change. So that's one thing we're going to talk about. We're going to get into a number of other issues which are adjacent to that, that are big in the news right now. But before we do, let me remind you that you should go out and order some Grady's Cold Brew iced coffee. Grady's Cold Brew is the sponsor of our podcast. It's made from a special blend of 100% Arabica beans, French chicory, and signature spices, and brewed overnight to give you a velvety smooth cup. You can drink iced, hot, or spiked in a cocktail, anything you want. Treat yourself to a gourmet cup of coffee without stepping foot outside, all for less than a buck a cup. If you're ready to give it a swirl, get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. So, David and Kate, what is up? What are we talking about?
Hey, Josh. Well, Kate and I were talking just before we came on the air. There's a bit of kind of breaking news unfolding pretty much as we're recording, which is the House is expected to cast its final vote for the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. It passed the Senate on Saturday, and then, you know, because of the changes to the legislation, needs a final House vote before it goes to Joe Biden's desk. And one of our favorite TPM characters, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, the QAnon congresswoman from Georgia, pulled a last minute stunt to try to slow things down, to basically kind of muck up the works. She called for a motion to adjourn. Kate, you wrote this up just this morning. Kind of tell us what her, I don't know what her motivation is and what a kind of crash and burn embarrassment it ended up being, because there was something like 40 Republicans voted against her motion, right?
Yeah, so this is something she's been doing constantly lately. You know, this time she says it's because it's a, let me see if I can get the quote right, a woke progressive Democrat wish list. But she's been doing it kind of all the time to gum up the works in the House, to the point that Republicans are getting pissed enough that they're going on the record and talking about how they don't like it.
Now, what exactly is that able to accomplish?
So she calls for a vote to adjourn, which makes everybody come back onto the floor to vote against the motion to adjourn, so everything can keep going. So, you know, that'll recall members from wherever they are, which, you know, including doing committee work, which is not an issue for her because she's not on any committees anymore. But, you know, it just really throws a wrench in. And even though it's kind of, you know, it's dumb, like the vote today, I think, took maybe tops 45 minutes, but it just slows everything down, gums up the works, pulls people off what they would otherwise be doing. And it's gotten to the point where McCarthy, in a closed door meeting with a conference, basically said, if you're going to do this kind of stuff, there has to be some strategy behind it. You can't just keep ruining everybody's day for no ostensible reason.
How many times has she done this where it forces a vote? I mean, roughly.
I mean, I think four times, like in the past couple of weeks. So I don't know exactly when she learned about this and started doing it, but.
So right. I guess the idea is that even if you're like a diehard, you know, Freedom Caucus Republican, if you're over in the other building doing committee and you have to get up and come back, that's still like annoying to you since it's not actually going to change anything. And as you say, as McCarthy said, it's not part of a messaging strategy or something. It's just something she came up with.
Right. I mean, and she has been joined by some other kind of more of the hardcore right type people. You know, I think the stunt they pulled last week was basically shutting down what would have been kind of no drama votes on, you know, housekeeping type stuff. Like one of the things was going to be giving some kind of gold medal to one of the Capitol police officers who was there, you know, the kind of renaming the post offices type stuff. They basically shut that down and made it be delayed. And, you know, it's kind of almost a very honest encapsulation of where that wing of the party is, which is no interest in legislating, obstructing to the point where it's almost this like abstract exercise that what are you even obstructing? It's just obstruction for obstruction's sake kind of thing. Yeah, and it's pissing off some other House Republicans who say they would like to kind of target their ire on at least slowing down the Biden administration's priorities and not just everything that the government ever does. But yeah, she pulled that this morning, made everybody come back and vote. And in that way, you know, people kind of like to point her out as this wild outlier, but Senate Republicans did a version of the same thing. I mean, Ron Johnson made them read the entire relief package, all 630 pages of it. And then, you know, Republicans announced a tranche of amendments to force votes on, slowing the bill's passage. So, you know, it's kind of a childish reaction to knowing that they don't actually have the votes to stopping this package getting passed. So they are just making life as difficult as possible for the Democrats who have the numbers to pass it. And out of the House, it's expected to pass this afternoon.
Right. I think that's a good point you made, Kate, that the Republicans really don't have a governing philosophy. It's all about, it's kind of like the own the libs, you know, strategy, basically stand in the way and try to shut things down and go back to your constituents and say, like, look how tough I am and look how I'm kind of fighting against, you know, the woke progressive majority, like you're saying.
Well, and the funny thing on that is I just wrote a quick piece before we came on about the Republicans' kind of attack messaging on the COVID relief plan have just been really all over the place. And I don't know if you could even call it an attack because it's been so half-hearted, but you know, McCarthy took the floor today and was going on about how socialism is growing in this body and this is a socialist package. And then, you know, you have Mitt Romney doing the more classic Republican, this is wasteful spending, you know. And then you have people like Green just basically seeming to base their opposition on the fact that it is a Democratic bill, you know. So it's just there really hasn't been any kind of unified talking points. It just seems to be using kind of these Republican buzzwords like socialism, liberal wish list, to be against a bill that is, you know, super popular. A New Morning Consult poll out this morning said that 59% of Republicans are in favor of it, 75% overall, you know, 90% of Democrats. So it's just this kind of like scattershot.
Wasn't there one, I saw one in that same poll, I think, that mm-hmm. even they had a separate grouping, which was 2020 Trump voters. And those were like 55.
Okay.
Like it was I'm pretty sure it's possible it's a different poll, but it was one out this morning. I think there was maybe also a CNN. I can't remember.
There was, a CNN too.
In any case, one of these polls, I think it was the one you're referring to, but I could be wrong about that. Again, created this separate category, and it was the lowest category, unsurprisingly. But it was striking that it was still majority, you know, kind of healthy majority support. I mean, I do think there's a lot of reasons why, you know, the big picture here, I think, is that Democrats are preventing Republicans from running the same playbook that they did in 2009. But to a great degree, what they did in 2009 was we are going to sort of you know, kind of put down a marker that this is socialism and wasteful and, you know, pork barrel spending for convicted murderers and all these kind of things. And then when we come to vote and things still kind of suck, we'll say, hey, that's because there was this wasteful socialism, blah, 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 blah. So it kind of fits there, right? You kind of, you can't leave it to other people to define something the way you want it defined. But there is, it's just a very different framework, and I am pleasantly surprised that it has the, you know, the levels of public support that it does. I'm not surprised that people support the actual things that are in it, but as we have learned in countless ways over decades, that often doesn't matter. Right. If it's just some kind of big spending thing and you know, that was definitely one of the people have talked about a lot about the various lessons learned from the early Obama years. And there are many. But one of them here was definitely even sort of explicitly the Obama brain trust message was basically, look, it's good policy. The stuff that is in there is going to be super good. And that's all that matters. You know, getting into and explaining this, that, or the other, that's not what matters. People, you know, the sort of the proof isn't, the proof in the pudding is in the eating or whatever. But I think we've learned that that's not true. And there were even other things, like a lot of the equivalent of sort of, you know, cash support aid, they said was supposed to be sort of invisible by the way you sort of tweaked with the tax withholdings. And I think we also know at this point, it was just not big enough. Right. There were a lot of substantive problems. But if you think about it, it's really quite remarkable. We're going to sneak it past you. Right. We're going to sneak past you the good things we're doing. Many lessons learned.
Like you say, Josh, the stimulus package ended up being much smaller than the Obama administration wanted to, because they knew that there weren't the moderate Democrat / Republican votes for having it as big as they wanted, which was initially, funnily enough, $1.2 trillion, you know, which is much smaller than this bill that we're getting passed today. But then, you know, that allowed Republicans to kind of turn around and be like, when it didn't work that well because it wasn't big enough, they said, see, this is what happens exactly when you do the pork barrel spending, which is something that's different here, which it's, you know, on its face shocking that a $1.9 trillion bill is about to get passed in this day and age. And, you know, all kind of the forecasts that we've had so far, especially about the anti-poverty effects of this bill, are tremendous. You know, they're about the poverty rate in 2021 going down by more than a quarter, you know, having the poverty rate for children in 2021. So I think that's another difference here, which is that the fact that they, you know, Democrats in Congress and the Biden administration managed to shepherd through a $1.9 trillion bill that's top line hardly came down at all, you know, means that Republicans are not probably so easily going to have this pivot back to, oh, and look, it didn't work, you know. Instead, Democrats are already kind of laying the groundwork for Republicans to basically go home to their districts and take credit for a bill that they worked against and didn't vote for.
You know, the other thing that's in terms of comparing the two bills, something that is worth keeping in mind, and, you know, I'll premise this, I'm obviously not an economist, but if anything, that somewhat understates how undergunned 2009 was, because one of the things about the current financial crisis versus theirs, versus the 2009 one, is this. And again, there are real counters to this argument, but broadly, I think there's something to it. Lots of people have actually saved a lot of money during this pandemic, and they didn't lose their assets, right? You know, their home didn't, I mean, some here and there, but the key thing in 2009 is that a whole swath of the population, let alone people who just lost their homes, that they lost a lot of their assets. Now, maybe those were inflated assets, blah, 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 but you have this massive reduction of spending power. So you need to kind of hugely goose the economy to get things moving again. Here, at least to a degree, lots of people are ready to, you know, they still have most of their money. You know, there's many cases where that is not the case, but lots of people still have lots of their money, and man, they can't wait to, you know, go on vacation or do this or do that or do the other. So if anything, you needed it to be bigger than this one is. Now, there's a lot of things that this one does that are, you know, we obviously didn't have a pandemic. You didn't need to kind of, you know, do a chunk of funding just to kind of, you know, get injections into people's arms. And there's a lot of stuff that is, you know, partly relief, but also just sort of changing the playing field in general, things that needed to be done. So in any case, it is, compared to what we see now as necessary, the bill in, you know, the bill in 2009 just wasn't even close to something that was going to get you quickly back to growth.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, like, we've been tracking the machinations of Joe Manchin on everything, you know, for weeks, but it I don't know. I think it does just bear taking a minute and realizing that the top line number didn't come down at all. You know, when we were first heading into these negotiations, the Republican position was basically a bill half the size of what ultimately came out, you know, like a few hundred billion maybe. And
or even a third the size. Wasn't the Collins Romney et al. Proposal, I think, was about $600 billion.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
So about a third. Yeah.
Right. A third of the size. And then, you know, and the popular wisdom then is, okay, the final product will be somewhere in the middle, you know. And it, the top line didn't come down at all. You know, you had Manchin kind of force the unemployment insurance benefit to come down $100 a week. The minimum wage didn't make it in. But I think just compared to the magnitude of the success in this bill, the fact that it looks like it's going to be a hugely effective tool in combating poverty because it's so aimed at low-income people, those losses just seem very small comparatively, not to mention that the fight on the minimum wage at least seems very much like it's going to continue.
Yeah, that's a good point. Josh and Kate, I'm curious to get your thoughts on why there is such overwhelming public support for this legislation, even among Republicans, even a majority among Trump 2020 voters, like you said, Josh. You know, I can think of a few reasons. One is that it's money in people's pockets, right? $1,400 is pretty significant almost no matter what your situation is, right? I mean,
well, and also one thing that and I hope they do more of this, that, you know, there's that whole is it 1400 or 2000, considering when the, you know, there's that thing that I think we all know about that debate. But in a way, 14 is really misleading because they expanded the number of people. You know, there's this whole issue with like adult dependents and all this kind of stuff. But really, for a family, which, you know, again, if you're a family of four, you don't really, and you're the, you're the husband or you're the wife or you're the kid, you don't really think about, well, I got my $1,400. I mean, that's not how family budgets work. It's the whole thing, right? I mean, obviously different families operate different ways, but basically it's the whole thing. And in many cases, everybody gets it. So what you're really talking about is like, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, which is for anybody, unless you're really well off, a significant chunk of money. And certainly if you are a family where, you know, total annual income is, you know, 40 to 60 to 70 grand or something like that, that's a ton of money. And that's not even all of the direct cash assistance or separate stuff for, you know, for kids and stuff. So it's a big deal. But to your question, I kind of do wonder. I mean, I'm kind of pleasantly surprised. I mean, I do think that one thing that we have to keep in mind is that we've had several relief bills, and the other ones also had checks. There's a lot of things they didn't have, but the public is sort of primed that we've had a series of relief bills, and I think people know that even if those were inadequate, they were helpful. You know, people got PPP loans, people got checks, you know, various different kinds of things. So I think some of it is that kind of like, yeah, we need another one. We're still having a hard time. I think they've made a decent argument about kind of like we need the money for vaccine distribution and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm kind of pleasantly surprised that the support seems as robust as it is.
Well, and part of it, I wonder, is, you know, kind of what I mentioned before, just the scattershot nature of the GOP opposition to it. You know, I think if you're kind of a more casual news consumer, there's not really one cohesive argument against the bill that you could cite, you know, throw out as why you don't like it. And I think you're right, Josh, the fact that this is just kind of the latest iteration of pandemic relief means that you already have people who accepted it when it was coming from the Trump administration.
So yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
That's asking
sort
for like
validated it.
Right. That's just asking for a lot of mental gymnastics to be like, I liked checks when they came from this person and not from this person, even in these polarized times.
It's also, though, this goes back to sort of how the parties have changed. I think another part of this, a significant part of it, is that Democrats went into this kind of like, we're not doing pay-fors, we're not getting into a debate about, you know, can we afford it and do we need to do this or that, or you know, we need a grand bargain in 2 years. They just jettisoned that whole conversation. And that was almost the entire conversation in 2009. You know, what can we afford? What, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they went into this. And if you think about it, within the Democratic caucus, that point has barely been contested, right? There's obviously the thing on the filibuster. There's contesting the minimum wage. But no one has kind of said, hey, we gotta, you know, pay for at least part of this. We gotta, and not having, you know, when you have that debate, set aside the substance of it, but just the fact that you don't have that debate and having Republicans kind of saying, oh, well, you know, Senator blah, 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 his concerns about deficit spending, and, you know, that kind of creates a whole thing and something you can grab onto. So the fact that Democrats have provided no validation for that entire area of discussion, I think that changes it a lot.
Well, and what a good argument for Democrats kind of going full steam ahead with their priorities and kind of ignoring the usual Republican belly aching. You know, I think you're right in that all it did is create less headlines about, you know, fighting over how to pay for it and everything. And it just went faster when they're not kind of waiting around for like the Susan Collins, will she, won't she thing. They just got it done and got it out the door. And while I think that's easiest to do on something like this, where there's a current and steadily worsening problem, you know, the Biden administration just kind of came in, had their few meetings with Republicans to be like, hey, we're playing ball, and then went ahead as planned, and it worked.
Yeah, I'm curious. One thing I don't really know how you can find this out, because it relies on people's candor, which is highly unlikely to be available. But I'm curious how much of this is as Senate Republicans expected, or whether they were thinking it was still going to be a version of 2009. And clearly they work, you know, the whole thing about, oh, Biden promised unity and now he's not giving us unity and we have no veto on his legislative agenda. Clearly that was an effort to kind of pry some of that back. But I mean, even when we started, I saw a headline of Susan Collins basically being very upset about Chuck Schumer basically blaming her for what happened in 2009. And I don't remember exactly. I mean, I think there's some very small case that I guess she did end up going along with some things, blah, 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 blah. But basically that every Democrat says very volubly, yeah, we're not doing that shit again. You know, you played us too many, we're done. And I think at some level, Republicans didn't quite get the pent up, not just frustration and anger, but just kind of like, we learned our lesson. You're not going to be able to do that again.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can shift gears, talk about the filibuster and what the future holds for that. Kate, you know, Josh gave us a good summary of Manchin's comments over the weekend at the top of the show. What struck you about those? Because I know you've been covering the future of the filibuster, and you know, you joined our Adam Gentleson briefing several weeks ago. And so I'm just curious what your reaction was to Manchin, and has that changed your thinking about, you know, the future of it?
Yeah, so I basically wrote last week that if you kind of read the tea leaves, both Sinema and Manchin seem to be leaving the door open to reform. This is before Manchin went on his kind of media circuit, but Sinema stood out to me because we had a reader send us in her, like, the stock letter that she responds to filibuster inquiries with. And it's only a few paragraphs long, but she talks about the talking filibuster, the death of the talking filibuster, the necessity for debate in the Senate multiple times in this short letter, which, you know, kind of struck me as, okay, so she says she won't kill the filibuster. She also says it's really important to her that there's debate on Senate bills, and specifically highlights the death of the talking filibuster, where it switched to when it is what it is today, where you basically just have to send an email to trigger the filibuster proceedings. So that seemed notable to me. And then you kind of had Manchin, meanwhile, you know, yelling at some reporter being like, Jesus Christ, stop asking me, I'm never going to kill it, blah, blah, blah. And then also starting out the administration with all these comments when people would ask him about the filibuster, saying, you know, my number one priority is that Joe Biden has a successful presidency. And we were like, well, how do you square those two things? You know, this would be how you square it. It's fine, they won't kill the filibuster. They're being unambiguous about that. But then you have Manchin go on these TV shows and say he wants to make it more painful for the minority to filibuster, which is basically Adam Jutlison kind of ran us through on this inside briefing, that there are reforms that you can do to force the minority to hold the floor when they're filibustering, and to, you know, actually force them to, that there's a punishment to filibustering, you know, a disincentive to do it on every single thing the majority tries to do, and to bring back the part of the filibuster, which, you know, don't want to gloss it over, was pretty much only used to interfere with civil rights legislation. It definitely has a dark history, that especially the talking filibuster does, but was used then to try to change people's minds about the legislation, not just stymie everything the majority tries to do. So now they're kind of presenting an opening for that, which is really important time-wise, because now that we're basically done with the COVID relief package, you know, some of the thought was that the next big kind of ambitious thing that the Biden administration wanted to do was the infrastructure / jobs package. And I think some of the early thought was that they could use reconciliation to do that too, and kind of circumvent the filibuster problem. But now we have Manchin saying that he's going to insist that at least they try to start going through regular order before using reconciliation. So now we're kind of at this place where whatever happens next in Congress is going to at least start going through regular order. And that's inevitably going to bring up the filibuster fight. And, you know, Dick Durbin, who's in Senate leadership, told reporters yesterday, kind of a rough outline, that they're going to bring two or three popular bills to the floor, which you can probably bet include the For the People Act, the voting rights package that the House recently passed, to basically force the conversation, force the debate, see how far Sinema and Manchin will go on reform. Because, you know, as we've been saying on this podcast for weeks, as soon as you have to go through normal order with a filibuster in place, that's kind of the end of Biden's legislative agenda, unless something changes.
Curious, Josh or Kate, if you have a sense of which legislative priority might ultimately trigger the demise of the filibuster, or the reforms such as, you know, such that it will be, you know, actual progress or unrecognizable from its previous form. Is it the minimum wage, or is it the HR1 package? You know, do you have a sense of what the catalyst might be?
It's funny. Like, on the one hand, the minimum wage thing seems like the obvious thing. Everybody can understand that. It's popular. There's, you know, huge, not just support, but militancy behind it among, you know, among Democrats, especially progressive Democrats, but really, you know, kind of across the board. But it's sort of, the footwork is sort of funny. If you were going to, you know, it's hard to make the final case for a majority rule on a bill that you don't seem to have majority support for, right? I mean, that, how does that work? Because it seems pretty clear that, you know, some of those eight Democrats who voted against it in that Votorama amendment thing, I don't think they're, like, Harper put out a statement basically saying, yeah, I'm for 15, but we need to phase it in a little less aggressively, or something like that. And I think he's basically talking about concerns that, you know, kind of coming out of the pandemic, you can't hit businesses that quickly with that big a labor cost increase, blah, 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 blah. But still, how do you do that exactly? I mean, I don't think, like maybe you could do it for, you know, $13, but then you get like lots and lots of Democrats really upset that you're, you know, that you're conceding on that. So the minimum wage seems like the obvious one to me, but like, I'm not so sure how that works if that's really the one you expect everything to come down on.
Right. And I think, I mean, it has to be something that Manchin / Sinema / the other Democrats who don't love the idea of reforming the filibuster want. You know, that just seems like the basic central thing.
Isn't there, I thought I saw somewhere where one example of where Manchin said, you know, the change might come for him is the voting rights bill, which I think is they titled it HR1. Am I correct about that? Yeah. Okay. HR1, which I was, you know, okay, that's, you know, great. I'm glad he's on board with that. I mean, it's a funny thing because that, I don't know. I mean, that, you know, Republicans are very dug in, you know, they're really against voting. Right. And so I'm not sure you're going to get the kind of numbers that you're seeing with the relief bill. We're kind of like, you know, even like a huge majority of Republicans are you know, a substantial majority of Republicans are for it. On the other hand, that bill is really existential for not just for democracy, but for Democrats. Right. I mean, if you got rid of, and that's a whole other discussion that I'm curious about, how what experts on this expect the, you know, court challenge fate will be of the provisions of that bill that get rid of partisan gerrymandering. But on just a lot of fronts, if for Democrats, you need to make sure that people are still going to be able to vote in 2022, right? And partisan, so maybe that's it. Although again, that is a kind of thing, you know, for, unfortunately for a lot of people, voting rights is very amorphous. And what does it mean? And why don't you need an ID to vote? We all have IDs. What's the problem? You know, it's a lot harder to understand than, like, you know, we're going to send your family $6,000.
Well, I think a couple things. One is, if we're looking kind of to the House for clues of what that legislation is going to be, not that it necessarily has to pass in the House first, it could pass in the Senate. But if you're thinking of a situation where you're trying to put pressure on the senators to get this passed, you know, it follows that the House has already done it, Senate's the last stop, then it becomes law, you know? And if we look at what the House has passed lately, it's been HR1. It was the Labor Act they did last night. And then Nancy Pelosi said yesterday that she'll have more to say on the minimum wage, on raising the minimum wage during her Thursday press conference. So kind of previewing that either as a standalone or into the infrastructure bill, you know, she's going to have something to say on that legislation. So that, from just the kind of movement on the Hill, seems to be where the pressure points kind of are right now. And specifically on HR1, when I was doing some reporting with filibuster types, you know, activist types, or those who are especially connected to, who used to work for Harry Reid, who tend to be like Adam Gentless and have become like the most kind of radicalized on the badness of the filibuster, all of them said it would be the voting rights package that would move the needle, because, you know, they were thinking the tension after, if Democrats did well enough, you know, to be in control of the chambers enough to control the legislative agenda, you have the backdrop of an election that Democrats just won narrowly, you know, that's going to kind of add some emotional resonance to this package. And then now, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if congressional leaders are kind of looking around at the state of Republican state legislatures all over the country that are doing this massive assault on voting rights, you know, especially in states that the Democrats won narrowly for the first time in decades. You know, you look at Georgia and Arizona, it's just an all out kind of assault. And so that would be my best guess, just because I think we've already seen congressional action around it. It's something Democrats are really passionate about. And there is an existential threat, you know, all those things seem to me to be kind of ingredients that would raise it on the list.
When I think about it, kind of by a process of elimination, I think it kind of has to be. I mean, there is that problem I described that voting rights, unfortunately, again, it's amorphous. A lot of things that are really important are hard to explain to people. You know, things like voter ID. I mean, it is really bad, but you ask any voting rights person will tell you, yes, our position votes terribly, polls terribly. It's just a reality. But there are those problems with the other issues and problems just the way I described. You know, how are you going to make your 51 vote case when you got 48 votes? That doesn't really work. And I really think, to the point, it will be hard for a lot of those members, including people like Manchin and Sinema, not to look at it and say, we're not going to be in power in 2 years unless we do this. And not that it guarantees that they'll still be in power, but at least from my perspective, Democrats could easily lose the House before the election even happens with partisan gerrymandering. So I've been thinking, I think it is quite plausible that you will have a 2022 election where the economy is doing really well, which again, you know, come out of the pandemic, you inject a ton of money into the economy. This isn't like, you know, kind of rosy-eyed thinking. There's a good chance that is going to be the case. So economy's doing well. People are liking Joe Biden. Democrats actually pick up seats in the Senate and yet lose the House just because it's already done with gerrymandering. Before you even get into all the restrictions on, you know, actually being able to vote, you know, just with that. So that does make sense to me.
That's my best guess too, as to 2022. But, and then you also, I think another thing that would probably make the Voting Act more likely to be the thing than the minimum wage is you have some Republicans at least pretending like they want to play ball on the minimum wage. You know, you had, Romney and someone else who I don't remember at this moment coming up with an 11-hour or $11 minimum wage, but then they kind of like stuffed in this poison pill of companies would have to use E-Verify to make sure they're not hiring undocumented workers, which seems kind of purposely planted in there to make it a non-starter with Democrats. But the fact that they are pretending like they will want to negotiate also, I think, would make a Manchin less likely to kind of pull the trigger there, because he'll be excited about the facade of bipartisanship. Whereas, you know, on voting rights, there is not going to be a single Republican even pretending like they're interested in doing that.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Maybe that's a good place to leave it for this week. I know we didn't get a chance, Kate, to talk about your reporting on the Capitol, Insurrection Commission, but next week we could return to that. Maybe there'll be more to share at that point, too.
Cool. Well, remember, the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM.
All right. All right. Talk to you next week.
Later, folks.
Bye.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader, too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.